listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of The Murders at Fort Hood by Mae Jong. The pursuit of happiness, or simply stability, will invariably lure people to the American military, which may be why the undocumented, the indigent, or those with a criminal record are overrepresented in its ranks. Among 1.29 million members of the U.S. military, 65,000 are immigrants, according to the Washington Post. This was true of many I met at Fort Hood, including press officer Major Gabriella Thompson, my tour guide on base, who told me she joined to pay off her student loans. "It was my ticket out," she said, echoing other soldiers' sentiments about how the military had rescued them from hardscrabble existences. The military is necessarily an institution of state-sanctioned violence, where we teach our young to kill on our behalf in the name of ideologies such as patriotism or democracy. Because what the military asks of its men and women is so antisocial, it must co-opt the rhetoric of the family. The purported motto of the Army was family first, mission second. Gary Schaefer, a non-commissioned officer who served at Fort Hood from 2012 to 2018 and who knew Wendell Morales through the car club scene, told me. But at Fort Hood, it sometimes seemed like mission first, equipment second, he said, highlighting the paradox of the military that in word puts the well-being of soldiers first, but in deed must, by design, favor combat readiness over all else. And being mission ready, the perpetual vigilance it requires ensures a kind of endless possibility of war, which in turn justifies the $740 billion annual defense budget. All this has been true since the founding of the American military, but a sense of disorientation has increased in recent years, as wars that were never good to begin with began to lose moral shine. It was unclear in 2020 what American soldiers were fighting for. Without any sense of purpose, the suffering at Fort Hood had started to lose its meaning. Dominic Criqui, who served in Vanessa Guillen's unit, says that the training had come to feel stupid and pointless. "What on earth are you training for?" he asks, then answers, "For nothing." Reformers would say that the military had failed its men and women, but with each encounter, it was becoming clear that the military had not failed its soldiers at all. Far from it. The military was operating as it had been intended. The sense of dehumanizing alienation soldiers complained about was not a symptom of a malfunctioning system. It was its original design. Part 4. Fault Lines. Amid all those other deaths, on June 21st, 2020, a search party found the charred lid of a cargo box along the Lyon River, 20 miles east of Fort Hood. On June 30th, a construction crew found shallow graves containing human remains that belonged to Guillen. Later, the same day, at 8:30 p.m., Aaron Robinson's girlfriend, Cecily Aguilar, changed her story and told Army investigators that Robinson had confessed to her that he killed Guillen in the arms room, beating her to death with a hammer. He had then driven the body to the Leon River and had come back to pick Aguilar up from the gas station where she worked on Veterans Memorial Boulevard, 5 miles east of Fort Hood. At first, Aguilar told investigators, they cut her up using a machete. Then they tried burning the body. They returned several days later to pour concrete over the remains. Yet instead of being taken into custody, Robinson was placed in a conference room on base. Initially, it was said, for committing adultery, which is against the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Later, Fort Hood confirmed it was for violating quarantine. A few hours later, Robinson, who had mostly been playing video games, escaped Fort Hood by car. After a chase along Rancier Avenue, the same street near which Lovell was found dead, Robinson shot himself and died. On July 14, 2020, a federal grand jury indicted Aguilar on 1 count of conspiracy and 2 counts of tampering with evidence. She pleaded not guilty. On April 30, 2021, Fort Hood found that Guillon had indeed been sexually harassed by a soldier, but not Robinson. Despite 10,000 hours of investigation and 300 interviews, much about Guillon's death remained a mystery. Who were the soldiers who had testified to seeing Guillon leave the arms room the day she disappeared? Had one of them stood in for Guillon during roll call? If not, what explained the false accounting? Had anyone helped Robinson clean up Guillon's murder in those 40 minutes? Why had it taken forensics 72 days to conduct a search of the arms room? Why hadn't the arms room been treated like the crime scene it was? Why was Robinson not put under watch? How had he managed to escape? And where had he gotten his gun? You can find Osama bin Laden, but you can't find a soldier that went missing on your own base, Guillon's younger sister Lupe says. The first week I spent in Texas that October, 22-year-old Lucas Hicks Mack went missing on base. He was found a day later. A few days later, so did 21-year-old specialist Trey Ring. Ever since returning from a deployment to Iraq in February 2019, shipped off 2 months after basic training for a 9-month tour, Ring had become withdrawn, developed a drinking problem, and had been arrested for drunk driving. He had also gotten married without telling his family, been evicted from his apartment, and stopped showing up to work. And so his disappearance was no surprise, his father told me. From the age of 18, the only thing I knew how to do was kill people, Ring wrote on the website of his father's veterans' rights organization. And how well will that look on your resume? I'm 21 now, and let me tell you, I've lost so much since I've been in. I've lost brothers and sisters in arms, a marriage, I've lost family, I've lost friendships that were supposed to be forever. I've even lost myself. Ring returned to base of his own accord later that day. In the same week, Private Edward Castile, who had been missing from Fort Hood since October 6th, was found in a parish jail in Louisiana, arrested after a high-speed chase. Castile had been stationed at Fort Hood since the end of June, where he'd been bullied for a spinal injury that consigned him to desk duties. Fort Hood had refused to list him as missing, and it was only after his then-fiancée, Paradise Rodriguez, posted a video on Facebook that an officer at the parish jail saw it and got into contact. Even then, it was she who had to scare up the $3,500 in bail money. And after Fort Hood sent two officers to pick up Castile, officials refused to share information with Rodriguez. Castile had told Rodriguez he was getting away from the abuse. Curiously, a few hours after the officers picked up Castile, he went silent online. Rodriguez sensed something was off. He seemed weird, Rodriguez said. He refused to send a selfie or get on a video chat and began using a strange and unfamiliar speech pattern. None of the messages added up, nor were they how he usually speaks to me, Rodriguez told me. After he returned to Fort Hood, Rodriguez managed to get Castile on a video call. I asked him directly if he wasn't willing to speak because of position, and he signaled yes, and he said, I'd rather tell you in person. Several days later, Rodriguez learned that Castile had been committed to a hospital on base. Fort Hood informed Rodriguez that he had asked for this. Rodriguez disputes this claim. That is the opposite of what he's been consistently saying. In fact, Castile had been convinced that CIA agents were attacking him since last June. The military, Rodriguez said, had known about this, but had refused to treat him. I guess my point is, Rodriguez told me, if everything was fine, the way Fort Hood officials would lead us to believe, then why would this soldier out of character leave base without permission, and why did he not feel comfortable enough to call his captain or anyone on that base once he was arrested for speeding? What happened on that base and in the Army to cause this person who was normally very kind and responsive to all of a sudden leave and shut down? When I ask soldiers at Fort Hood what they thought was the matter on base, they mentioned toxic leadership, a Catholic term that seemed to encompass all, lack of care, general command climate, and so-called toxic masculinity. There was also literal toxicity on base, in that some of the mold-infested barracks where soldiers lived were technically condemned, according to Maureen Elliott, a military spouse and a housing advocate. Toxic leadership is nothing new. The ancient Greeks wrote epic poems on the subject, the most famous of which is the Iliad. Agamemnon demonstrates disrespect, vanity, and other lapses in judgment, the result of which is what clinical psychiatrist Jonathan Shea describes as moral injury. A, 1, betrayal of what's right, 2, by someone who holds legitimate authority, 3, in a high-stakes situation. Such moral injury deteriorates social trust, which is then replaced by the settled expectancy of harm, exploitation, and humiliation from others, resulting in despair and violence to self and to others. After the public remonstrations began, Fort Hood launched something it called Operation Phantom Action, a week-long retreat of sorts that was meant to rebuild trust between soldiers and the leadership. A sergeant from Guillon's division called it Mandatory Fun Days. The additional scrutiny, the congressional delegation visit, press tours, meant that soldiers had to work harder. Many complained specifically of being made to cut grass to ready for such official visits. The Army's own investigation found major flaws at Fort Hood, leading to the firing or suspending of 14 officials. Fort Hood refused all official interview requests for this story, citing ongoing investigations. As publication approached, it stopped responding to emails pertaining to both specific questions about individual cases, as well as broader queries about the base. As distressing as the remains in shallow graves or the missing hyoid bone is, the fatalism from soldiers and locals alike. None of the grunts I spoke to was surprised by the number of casualties. Beyond the base, gas station attendants and restaurant servers, many of whom were veterans or had ties to the military, all seemed resigned to certain fates. They pointed glumly to past cases, some of which there were public records for, and others I could find no traces of in the official files. Women, who make up 17% of active duty military, were doubly bereft, and the case files were awash with stories of the dead. Last December, an internal investigation found that Fort Hood's culture, environment, and leadership resulted in women feeling vulnerable and preyed upon, with no reliable recourse for their very real sense of duress. Before Guion, there had been Private Lavena Lynn Johnson, who was found dead in a tent in 2005 in Iraq. It was ruled a suicide until her father noticed her broken nose, black eye, loose teeth, and burns on her genitals. In 2007, also in Iraq, Specialist Kamisha Block's death was ruled an accident by a single shot of friendly fire before the family received the body and saw that she had 5 gunshot wounds, including one to the head. Also that year, Marine Lance Corporal Maria Lauterbach was raped by her superior, which she reported. He ultimately murdered her when she was 8 months pregnant, then set her on fire before fleeing to Mexico. Around the Guion murals in Killeen and in Houston, I met people who had lost loved ones to the military, who felt harm done, who saw in Guion a savior. "She doesn't belong to the Army anymore," Ana Luisa Tapia, a local organizer, told me. "She is now for the movement." In death, Guion has become a kind of patron saint for all those who feel wronged by the U.S. military. In death, she is no longer a daughter or a sister or a partner. She has become that complicated, indelible thing, a hero. Hunter Schafer is making the kind of television she wants to watch, by Britt Hennemuth. After 2 years trailblazing such runways as Miu Miu and Marc Jacobs, 22-year-old actor, writer, and producer Hunter Schafer landed a starring role on HBO's Euphoria. Playing 17-year-old trans teen Jules Vaughn, Schafer, who in 2016 was a plaintiff in the American Civil Liberties Union lawsuit against North Carolina House Bill 2, which required people to use the restroom associated with the sex they were assigned at birth, brought her own experience to the groundbreaking role. This year, Schafer co-wrote and co-produced a special episode for Euphoria, emerging as a crucial voice in a new era of storytelling. The oldest of four siblings, she was raised in North Carolina by her mother and pastor father and transitioned in high school. She says she fell into acting. "It was not in my plan. I was in New York modeling and saving up to go to fashion school. Then Euphoria came along and I decided to go for it." She was enrolled at London's prestigious Central St. Martin's Arts and Design College when she landed the role. "We started filming in L.A. the same month. I was supposed to start school. I don't think I ever told them that I wasn't coming." The series was nominated for 6 Emmys and won 3. Its visceral depiction of high school life garnered controversy and praise. The young cast launched into a daunting level of exposure. "I wasn't expecting to be this vulnerable with such a large group of people." She calls fame a wild thing that has taken some getting used to. The idea for the episode she co-wrote came when Jules, whether or not she was a villain, started trending on Twitter. "It pissed us off. We understand Jules's narrative with a care that not everyone had experienced yet." She describes Euphoria creator Sam Levinson, with whom she wrote the episode, as "my mentor, my L.A. mother, one of my best friends." Writing and producing the episode, which explores Jules's memories through a therapy session, came naturally. "I loved the technicalities of imagining what the room is like, what she's wearing." The episode title, "F Anyone Who's Not a Sea Blob," is a layered statement in that everyone has an amoebic or fluid feeling inside of them. It's a matter of whether or not you're tapped into acknowledging it. What's next? There are love stories, particularly for the people in my community, the ways that we move throughout the world that are unique. That's something I really want to make stuff about. Also by Britt Hennemuth, California Conscience. In a year when philanthropy took on increased importance, Kelly Sawyer Petrikoff and Nora Weinstein, co-CEOs of the Los Angeles-based nonprofit Baby to Baby, which distributes such essentials as school supplies and diapers to those in need, have doubled their donations. "In 2020, we had a 9-year history with 100 million items," says Weinstein. 50 million of those were given out since COVID. The charity is beloved among Hollywood mothers. Ambassadors and honorees include Gwyneth Paltrow, Amy Adams, Chrissy Teigen, and Jessica Alba, and was the only American nonprofit that Harry and Meghan volunteered with to celebrate their son's first birthday. The founders are aiming higher. "With the fire, flood, and pandemic relief efforts, we have huge goals," stresses Petrikoff. "What about the next billion items?" In the photos, Kelly Sawyer, Petrikoff, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Nora Weinstein, Jessica Alba at a Baby to Baby event. On books, Righteous Muse, David Duchovny's fourth novel, truly like lightning, published by FSG, follows the family of a religious, polygamous, former stuntman up against an ambitious investment exec bent on acquiring his land. The X-Files star and novelist list his inspirations. American Pastoral by Philip Roth. My ambition was to engage with sweeping American novels of the last 50 years. For me, at the top of that list is American Pastoral, which, because it is so toweringly great, would be the last thing I would read while writing. The Svengoolie Channel. On Saturday nights, I'd watch the Svengoolie program, schlock horror from back in the day, like the two titles that figure in the book, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde in 1971, and the lesbian undead flick The Vampire Lovers, 1970. Inagata Davida by Iron Butterfly. I was calling the novel's utopian compound Agata Davida because those nonsense syllables contain Edenic hope underneath the song's trance-like, muscular, spinal-tapping darkness.
Thank you.
Will woke go up in smoke? What I do know is virtue usually flowers when you're vulnerable, by Jenny Lumet. In the Whole Foods on Montana Avenue, at the top of the lockdown and right after George Floyd's murder, a Santa Monica lady and I reached for the same avocado at the same time. When I say Santa Monica lady, I mean a white lady. Her child was beautiful, like all the children in the Whole Foods. They were masked, beautiful, healthy, reverse bandits, as there was nothing they would ever steal. They only wanted to give back. I know this because I read their T-shirts. These were people to whom things mattered. I was also masked, a masked black person. Side note, my mother, 84, lives on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and goes daily to Marsh Madison, which is her nearest grocery store. There are very few essentials at this store, mostly things you'd choose to eat as opposed to things you'd need to eat. My mother refers to herself as the masked Negro of Marsh Madison. Mother is a savage. During the avocado skirmish, I registered Santa Monica lady's confusion at my pale pigmentation. She was not the first, nor will she be the last. The spectrum of American blackness is vast and beautiful. I have a white father and am also the direct descendant of enslaved Africans. My children's DNA is in the floorboards of the Calhoun Mansion in South Carolina. John C. Calhoun himself is my great times five grand rapist. Proximity to whiteness comes with privileges, far too many to list here. In the movie business, as in every other business, I suspect, you certainly get hired faster and more often. And you get called the N-word by the recipient of a Golden Globe, and then again by an EGOT. Hashtag moving on up. The Santa Monica lady's confusion. Was I white? And if I was white, did that mean it was okay if she just claimed the avocado? Only lasted a beat before she erred on the side of wokeness. I'm sorry, she said. I'm so, so sorry. I know why she was sorry. She feared that I, a masked black stranger, would perceive her as a bad person. And when I say bad person, I mean a racist. A person who felt entitled to take the avocado, as she had been taking avocados all her life. First, ahead of. The fact that she feared I might think this of her confirms that she may well have been a racist and had apologized only because she had watched George Floyd's murder on her TV. How do I know what was triple sow-chowing through her brain? I know because I know. Experience is expertise. You can't buy or relocate out of this bullshit. You can't just say I'm sticking to the coast. I also know because the sow chow has permutations, and I've done a version of it myself. One time, during a 12-day hospital stay in New York City years ago, while I was sick as a dog, my roommate, a black lady, was garrulous. She had her entire family visiting, and they were garrulous too. It was the yellingest family in Lenox Hill Hospital. I was trying not to die. So I said nothing but passive-aggressively shot baleful, wounded glances in their direction. The behavior, thought I. My thought bubble has the British spelling. That's how much of an asshole I am. And a member of the lady's family said, that white girl thinks we're too loud. Alarum, accent, accent. Immediately defensive and panicked, I longed to say, wait. I'm not a white girl and a racist. I'm a black girl who's internalized colorism. When the toxin has lived in you, you can smell it in other people. So I knew about the Santa Monica avocado lady because I know. And here's my question. Now that it's no longer 2020, will woke go up in smoke? To my understanding, wokeness is a thing that means you take a real look at the world and how you move through it. If one is an asshole, one tries to remedy. I am always working on that one. Always. And it's a process. No one just hears the alarm and leaps out of bed. Mostly, we all hit snooze 70 billion times and then wonder why we're late. There's a long history of public murder and of hitting the snooze button. I did a very non-scientific poll among my friends. All of them are women and very, very tired. Will woke go up in smoke? I asked them. One of my friends is a phone sex worker, and she deals with folk on a pretty primal level. She is always a black woman, but sometimes not. Depends who might be calling. I had a guy who had curated his fantasies to make sure I know he's woke, like I care, and he doesn't want to do it anymore, she told me. Since November, he's just been rage venting. He did everything he was supposed to do, but everyone's still mad at him. Wait, everyone's mad at him? Everyone who? I don't know. The black lady in his office, she makes him feel castrated or something. Now he's angry. He's angry at the language. I was like, you know, you're actually in a safe space now, right? And he totally lost his heart on. Boom. He doesn't want to hear about safe spaces or talk about this shit anymore. F. I wasn't making this guy be woke. By the way, he's super dumb now. Okay, here's what I deduced from all this. 1. My friend is doing the Lord's work. 2. Woke is sustainable only under a very particular set of circumstances. 3. Woke is unsustainable while effing. I'm the 4th generation of my family. Yep, the 4th. To work in show business. And the only thing I know for sure is that virtue usually flowers when you're vulnerable. I created a show about a black family at a big streaming service. Not the streamer on which I currently have shows. Said show was based on my fancy family. The head people in charge, all of whom were Santa Monica ladies, including the guys, said, "We love your fancy family. We love the sophistication. Please let us know if we say anything racist, dumb, or do anything racist, stupid." They were vulnerable. They were, like the Santa Monica lady, afraid they would be judged and found wanting. That judgment would live in the tiniest corner of their brain and haunt them like the fitted sheet that doesn't match anything anymore, but is somehow always in the effing closet. And then, somehow, they weren't afraid. Maybe it was repeated exposure. They said, "Do you guys really talk like that? And also, can we have a scene where someone is getting thrown over a cop car for relatability? Because we feel the privilege of your family is getting in the way of our commentary on race." My blackness was getting in the way of their commentary on race. These were suddenly some very confident Santa Monica ladies. At the 11th hour, they asked if we could introduce the lightest-skinned character first. Colorism was a theme of the show, so the blackness of her family could be a reveal. Ha ha, funny. I confronted. They said I ask loaded questions and shouldn't. I made a bet with the showrunner that their next show about black people would have slaves in it. I won. For many, the miasma of fear that was 2020 is lifting. There are vaccines. Those people no longer live in the White House. Many, myself included, feel less vulnerable. It's going to get better. and a lot of people will be happy not to talk about this shit anymore. One of my friends insists wokeness is here to stay. There's a whole new level of awareness, she says. The bell has been rung. It's been ringing forever, but whatever. Yet the Zooms of my world still look like my high school yearbook, the Dalton School, New York City, class of 1984. In other words, thumbprints of whiteness punctuated with the rare brown exclamation point. I heard a famous black comedian talk about Me Too. This connects. Hang on. He seemed to have complex feelings about it, to which he's entitled. But then he said, "Ladies, you don't tell on us as much as you could. We know that. But it's going to be worse for you when this moment goes away." I don't think it was a threat, though it felt like one. I think he believed he was warning us of the punishment to come. Me Too will go away. The tolerance for listening will max out, and Dad will turn around and say, "You've had your fun. I'm pulling this goddamn car over right now." And then beat the kids for having a moment.
Thank you.
Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Sophia Loren, the Oscar-winning legend and star of The Life Ahead, talks whipped cream and self-acceptance. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A plate of fettuccine ragu with my kids. What is your greatest fear? To overcook that plate of fettuccine. What do you dislike most about your appearance? After 86 years, I'm past disliking parts of my appearance. Which living person do you most admire? Kamala Harris. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I was raised in Pozzuoli. I'm not sure I identify with any historical figures. I identify with normal people. I identify with my grandmother. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Moderation, especially when it comes to desserts. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I'm a perfectionist. It's boring. What is your greatest extravagance? I nap after lunch. When and where were you happiest? In the hospital, when my children were born. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Vanity. On what occasion do you lie? When I don't want to hurt feelings. What is your favorite journey? Going to Rome to see my sister, or going to Los Angeles to see my children? Where would you like to live? I like where I live. Which talent would you most like to have? Singing. What is your current state of mind? Serene. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My 2 children and 4 grandchildren. What is your favorite occupation? Eating, especially pasta and desserts with whipped cream. What is your greatest regret? That I didn't get married in a white dress. What is it that you most dislike? Gossip. What is the quality you most like in a man? Honesty and humor. What is the quality you most like in a woman? Honesty and courage. How would you like to die? It's bad luck even to think of such things. Who are your favorite writers? Eduardo De Filippo, Alberto Moravia, Romain Gary. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Madame Rosa. What is your most treasured possession? My memories and my experience. What are your favorite names? Carlo, Eduardo, Lucia, Leonardo, Vittorio, Beatrice. What is your motto? Calma, sangue freddo e fiducia nei mezzi impiegati. Be calm, stay cool, and trust your means. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Sophia Loren. Shining Sea by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Maggie DeMarco and Scott Semler. After he joined forces with Tiffany and Company in 1956, the late Parisian jeweler Jean Schlumberger paired his fondness for designs inspired by nature with a jewelry titan's profusion of colored stones to dazzling effect. His archive is a veritable menagerie rendered in fine gems. Schlumberger's legacy lives on in this purple sapphire and diamond ring housed inside a whimsical gold and silver box in the shape of a sea urchin. All beauty, no spines. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.